So, would you mind telling me what's going on? She asks. She turns to face him, lifts the mug to her lips, and finally looks him straight in the eye. Randy's a little nonplussed. The question is basically impertinent coming from America Shafto. Her company, Semper Marine Services, is a contractor at the very lowest level of Abbey's virtual corporation, only one of a dozen boats and divers outfits that they could have hired. So this is a bit like being interrogated by one's janitor or taxi driver. But she's smart and unusual, and precisely because of all her efforts not to be, she's cute. As an interesting female and a fellow American, she is pulling rank, demanding to be accorded a higher status. Randy tries to be careful. "Is there something bothering you?" he asks. She looks away. She's afraid she's given him the wrong impression. "Not in particular," she says. "I'm just nosy. I like to hear stories. Divers always sit around and tell each other stories." Randy sips his coffee. America continues. "In this business, you never know where your next job is going to come from. Some people have really weird reasons for wanting to get stuff done underwater, which I like to hear." She concludes, "It's fun." Which is clearly all the motivation she needs. Randy views all of the above as a fairly professional bullshitting job. He decides to give Amy press release material only. All the Filipinos are in Manila. That's where the information needs to go. It is somewhat awkward getting information to Manila because it has mountains in back of it and Manila Bay in front. The bay is a nightmare place to run some marine cables. She's nodding. Of course, she would know this already. Randy hits the fast forward. Corregidor's a pretty good place. From Corregidor, you can shoot a line-of-sight microwave transmission across the bay to downtown Manila. "So you're extending the North Luzon coastal festoon from Subic Bay down to Corregidor?" she says.
Two things about what you just said," Randy says, and pauses for a moment to get the answer queued up in his output buffer. "One, you have to be careful about your pronouns. What do you mean when you say you? I work for Epiphyte Corporation, which is designed from the ground up to work, not on its own, but as an element in a virtual corporation, kind of like..."
"I know what an Epiphyte is," she says. "What's two?"
"Okay, good," Randy says, a little off balance. "Two is that the extension of the North Luzon festoon is just the first of what we hope will be several link-ups. We want to lay a lot of cable eventually into Corregidor."
Some kind of machinery behind Amy's eyes begins to hum. The message is clear enough. There will be work aplenty for Semper Marine if they handle this first job well. In this case, the entity that's doing the work is a joint venture, including us, Philatel, 24 Jam, and a big Nipponese electronics company, among others.
"What does 24 Jam have to do with it? They're convenience stores."
"Well, they're the retail outlet, the distribution system for Epiphyte's product."
"And that is?"
"Pinoy Grahams."
Randy manages to suppress the urge to tell her that the name is trademarked.
"Pinoy Grahams?"
"Well, here's how it works. You are an overseas contract worker. Before you leave home for Saudi or Singapore or Seattle or wherever, you buy or rent a little gizmo from us. It's about the size of a paperback book and encases a thimble-sized video camera, a tiny screen, and a lot of memory chips. The components come from all over the place. They are shipped to the free port at Subic and assembled in a Nipponese plant there. So they cost next to nothing. Anyway, you take this gizmo overseas with you. Whenever you feel like communicating with the folks at home, you turn it on, aim the camera at yourself, and record a little video greeting card. It all goes onto the memory chips. It's highly compressed. Then you plug the gizmo into a phone line and let it work its magic."
"What's the magic? It sends the video down the phone line?"
"Right."
"Haven't people been messing around with video phones for a long time?"
"Well, the difference here is our software. We don't try to send the video in real time. That's too expensive. We store the data at central servers, then take advantage of lulls when traffic is low through the undersea's cables, and shoot the data down those cables when time can be had cheap. Eventually, the data winds up at Epiphyte's facility in Entremoros. From there, we can use wireless technology to send the data to 24 Jam stores all over Metro Manila. The store just needs a little pie plate dish on the roof and a decoder and a regular VCR down behind the counter.
The Pinoygram is recorded on a regular videotape. Then when Mom comes in to buy eggs or Dad comes in to buy cigarettes, the storekeeper says, "Hey, you got a Pinoygram today," and hands them the videotape. They can take it home and get the latest news from their child overseas. When they're done, they bring the videotape back to 24 Jam for reuse. About halfway through this, Amy understands the basic concept, looks out the window again, and begins trying to work a fragment of breakfast out of her teeth with the tip of her tongue. She does it with her mouth tastefully closed, but it seems to occupy her thoughts more than the explanation of Pinoygrams. Randy is gripped by a crazy, unaccountable desire not to bore Amy. It's not that he is getting a crush on her, because he puts the odds at 50-50 that she's a lesbian, and he knows better. She is so frank, so guileless, that he feels he could confide anything in her, as an equal. This is why he hates business. He wants to tell everyone everything. He wants to make friends with people. "So, let me guess," she says. "You are the guy doing the software." "Yeah," he admits, a little defensive. "But the software is the only interesting part of this whole project. All the rest is making license plates." That wakes her up a little. "Making license plates?" "It's an expression that my business partner and I use," Randy says. "With any job, there's some creative work that needs to be done, new technology to be developed or whatever. Everything else, 99% of it, is making deals, raising capital, going to meetings, marketing and sales. We call that stuff making license plates." She nods, looking out the window. Randy is on the verge of telling her that Pinoygrams are nothing more than a way to create cash flow, so that they can move on to part two of the business plan. He is sure that this would elevate his stature beyond that of dull software boy. But Amy puffs sharply across the top of her coffee, like blowing out a candle, and says, "Okay, thanks. I guess that was worth the 3 packs of cigarettes." Nightmare. Bobby Shafto has become a connoisseur of nightmares. Like a fighter pilot ejecting from a burning plane, he has just been catapulted out of an old nightmare and into a brand new, even better one. It is creepy and understated. No giant lizards here. It begins with heat on his face. When you take enough fuel to push a 50,000-ton ship across the Pacific Ocean at 25 knots and put it all in one tank and the Nips fly over and torch it all in a few seconds, while you stand close enough to see the triumphant grins on the pilots' faces, then you can feel the heat on your face in this way. Bobby Shafto opens his eyes, expecting that in so doing, he is raising the curtain on a corker of a nightmare. Probably the final moments of Torpedo Bombers at 2 o'clock, his all-time favorite, or the surprise beginning of Strafed by Yellowmen 17. But the soundtrack to this nightmare does not seem to be running. It is as quiet as an ambush. He is sitting up in a hospital bed surrounded by a firing squad of hot Klieg lights that make it difficult to see anything else. Shafto blinks and focuses on an eddy of cigarette smoke hanging in the air like spilled fuel oil in a tropical cove. It sure smells good. A young man is sitting near his bed. All that Shafto can see of this man is an asymmetrical halo where the lights glance from the petroleum glaze on his pompadour and the red coal of his cigarette. As he looks more carefully, he can make out the silhouette of a military uniform, not a marine uniform. Lieutenant's bars gleam on his shoulders, light shining through double doors. "Would you like another cigarette?" the lieutenant says. His voice is hoarse, but weirdly gentle. Shafto looks down at his own hand and sees the terminal half-inch of a lucky strike wedged between his fingers.
"Ask me a tough one,"
he manages to say. His own voice is deep and slurred, like a gramophone winding down. The butt is swapped for a new one. Shafto raises it to his lips. There are bandages on that arm, and underneath them he can feel grievous wounds trying to inflict pain, but something is blocking the signals. Ah, the morphine. It can't be too bad of a nightmare if it comes with morphine, can it? "You ready?" the voice says. God damn it, that voice is familiar.
Sir, ask me a tough one, sir,
Shapto says. You already said that.
Sir, if you ask a Marine if he wants another cigarette or if he's ready, the answer is always the same, sir.
That's the spirit, the voice says. Roll film. A clicking noise starts up in the outer darkness beyond the Klieg-light firmament.
Rolling, says a voice.
Something big descends towards Shapto. He flattens himself into the bed because it looks exactly like the sinister eggs laid in midair by Nip dive bombers. But then it stops and just hovers there.
Sound,
says another voice. Shapto looks harder and sees that it is not a bomb, but a large bullet-shaped microphone on the end of a boom. The lieutenant with the pompadour leans forward now, instinctively seeking the light, like a traveler on a cold winter's night. It is that guy from the movies. What's his name? Oh, yeah! Ronald Reagan has a stack of 3x5 cards in his lap. He skids up a new one. What advice do you, as the youngest American fighting man ever to win both the Navy Cross and the Silver Star, have for any young Marines on their way to Guadalcanal? Shapto doesn't have to think very long. The memories are still as fresh as last night's 11th nightmare. 10 plucky nips and suicide charge.
Just kill the one with the sword first.
Ah, Reagan says, raising his waxed and penciled eyebrows and cocking his pompadour in Shafto's direction. Smart. You target them because they're the officers, right?
No, fuckhead, Shapto yells. You kill them because they've got fucking swords. You ever had anyone running at you waving a fucking sword?
Reagan backs down. He's scared now, sweating off some of his makeup, even though a cool breeze is coming in off the bay and through the window. Reagan wants to turn tail and head back down to Hollywood and nail a starlet fast. But he's stuck here in Oakland, interviewing the war hero. He flips through a stack of cards, rejects about 20 in a row. Shapto's in no hurry. He's going to be flat on his back in this hospital bed for approximately the rest of his life. He incinerates half of that cigarette with one long breath, holds it, blows out a smoke ring. When they fought at night, the big guns on the warships made rings of incandescent gas. Not fat donuts, but long, skinny ones that twisted around like lariats. Shapto's body is saturated with morphine. His eyelids avalanche down over his eyes, blessing those orbs that are burning and swollen from the film lights and the smoke of the cigarettes. He and his platoon are racing an incoming tide, trying to get around a headland. They are Marine raiders, and they have been chasing a particular unit of Nips across Guadalcanal for 2 weeks, whittling them down. As long as they're in the neighborhood, they've been ordered to make their way to a certain point on the headland, from which they ought to be able to lob mortar rounds against the incoming Tokyo Express. It is a somewhat harebrained and reckless tactic, but they don't call this Operation Shoestring for nothing. It is all wacky improvisation from the get-go. They are behind schedule because this paltry handful of Nips has been really tenacious, setting ambushes behind every fallen log, taking potshots at them every time they come around one of these headlands. Something clammy hits him on the forehead. It is the makeup artist taking a swipe at him. Shapto finds himself back in the nightmare within which the lizard nightmare was nested.
Did I tell you about the lizard?
Shapto says.
Several times, his interrogator says. This'll just take another minute.
Ronald Reagan squeezes a fresh 3x5 card between thumb and forefinger, fastening onto something a little less emotional.
What did you and your buddies do in the evenings when the day's fighting was done?
Pile up dead Nips with a bulldozer, Shapto says, and set fire to 'em. Then go down to the beach with a jar of hooch and watch our ships get torpedoed.
Reagan grimaces.
Cut,
he says, quietly but commanding. The clicking noise of the film camera stops.
How'd I do?
Bobby Shapto says as they are squeegeeing the Maybelline off his face and the men are packing up their equipment. The Klieg lights have been turned off. Clear Northern California light streams in through the windows. The whole scene looks almost real, as if it weren't a nightmare at all.
You did great, Lieutenant Reagan says, without looking him in the eye. A real morale booster.
He lights a cigarette.
You can go back to sleep now.
Ha!
Shafto says.
I've been asleep the whole time, haven't I?
He feels a lot better once he gets out of the hospital. They give him a couple of weeks of leave, and he goes straight to the Oakland station and hops the next train for Chicago. Fellow passengers recognize him from his newspaper pictures, buy him drinks, pose with him for snapshots. He stares out the windows for hours, watching America go by, and sees that all of it is beautiful and clean. There might be wildness, there might be deep forest, there might even be grizzly bears and mountain lions, but it is cleanly sorted out, and the rules, don't mess with bear cubs, hang your food from a tree limb at night, are well known and published in the Boy Scout manual. In those Pacific islands, there is too much that is alive, and all of it is in a continual process of eating and being eaten by something else, and once you set foot in the place, you're buying into the deal. Just sitting in that train for a couple of days, his feet in clean white cotton socks, not being eaten alive by anything, goes a long way towards clearing his head up. Only once, or possibly two or three times, does he really feel the need to lock himself in the can and squirt morphine into his arm. But when he closes his eyes, he finds himself on Guadalcanal, sloshing around that last headland, racing the incoming tide. The big waves are rolling in now, picking up the men and slamming them into rocks. Finally, they turn the corner and see the cove, just a tiny notch in the coast of Guadalcanal. 100 yards of tidal mudflats, backed up by a cliff. They will have to get across those mudflats and establish a foothold on the lower part of the cliff if they aren't going to be washed out to sea by the tide. The Shaftos are Tennessee mountain people, miners among other things. About the time Nimrod Shafto went to the Philippines, a couple of his brothers moved up to western Wisconsin to work in lead mines. One of them, Bobby's grandpa, became a foreman. Sometimes he would go to Oconomowoc to pay a visit to the owner of the mine, who had a summer house on one of the lakes. They would go out in a boat and fish for pike. Frequently, the mine owner's neighbors, owners of banks and breweries, would come along. That is how the Shaftos moved to Oconomowoc, and got out of mining and became fishing and hunting guides. The family has been scrupulous about holding on to the ancestral twang, and to certain other traditions, such as military service. One of his sisters and two of his brothers are still living there with Mom and Dad, and his two older brothers are in the Army. Bobby's not the first to have won a Silver Star, though he is the first to have won the Navy Cross. Bobby goes and talks to Oconomowoc's Boy Scout troop. He gets to be Grand Marshal of the town parade. Other than that, he hardly budges from the house for 2 weeks. Sometimes he goes out into the yard and plays catch with his kid brothers. He helps Dad fix up a rotten dock. Guys and gals from his high school keep coming round to visit, and Bobby soon learns the trick that his father and his uncles and granduncles all knew, which is that you never talk about the specifics of what happened over there. No one wants to hear about how you dug half of your buddy's molars out of your leg with a point of a bayonet. All of these kids seem like idiots and lightweights to him now. The only person he can stand to be around is his great-grandfather Shafto, 94 years of age and sharp as a tack, who was there at Petersburg when Burnside blew a huge hole in the Confederate lines with buried explosives and sent his men rushing into the crater where they got slaughtered. He never talks about it, of course, just as Bobby Shafto never talks about the lizard. Soon enough, his time is up, and then he gets a great send-off at the Milwaukee train station, hugs Mom, hugs Sis, shakes hands with Dad and the brothers, hugs Mom again, and he's off. Bobby Shafto knows nothing of his future. All he knows is that he has been promoted to sergeant, detached from his former unit. No great adjustment, since he is the only surviving member of his platoon, and reassigned to some unheard-of branch of the Corps in Washington, D.C. D.C.'s a busy place, but last time Bobby Shafto checked the newspapers, there wasn't any combat going on there, and so it's obvious he's not going to get a combat job. He's done his bit anyway, killed many more than his share of nips, won his medals, suffered from his wounds. As he lacks administrative training, he expects that his new assignment will be to travel around the country being a war hero, raising morale and suckering young men into joining the Corps. He reports, as ordered, to Marine Barracks, Washington, D.C. It's the Corps' oldest post, a city block halfway between the Capitol and the Navy Yard, a green quadrangle where the Marine Band struts and the drill team drills. He half expects to see strategic reserves of spit and a polish stored in giant tanks nearby. Two Marines are in the office, a major, who is his new nominal commanding officer, and a colonel, who looks and acts like he was born here. It is shocking beyond description that two such personages would be there to greet a mere sergeant. Must be the Navy Cross that got their attention. But these Marines have Navy Crosses of their own, two or three apiece. The major introduces the colonel in a way that doesn't really explain a damn thing to Shafto. The colonel says next to nothing. He's there to observe. The major spends a while fingering some typewritten documents.
Says right here you are gung-ho.
Sir, yes, sir.
What the hell does that mean?
Sir, it is a Chinese word. There's a communist there named Mao, and he's got an army. We tangled with him on more than one occasion, sir. Gung-ho is their battle cry. It means all together or something like that. So after we got done kicking the crap out of them, sir, we stole it from them, sir.
Are you saying you've gone Asiatic like those other China Marines, Shafto?
Sir, on the contrary, sir, as I think my record demonstrates, sir.
You really think that?
The major says incredulously.
We have an interesting report here on a film interview that you did with some soldier.
A deprecatory term for a fighting man not good enough to be in the Corps.
Named Lieutenant Reagan.
Sir, this Marine apologizes for his disgraceful behavior during that interview, sir. This Marine let down himself and his fellow Marines, sir.
Aren't you going to give me an excuse? You were wounded. Shell-shocked, drugged, suffering from malaria.
Sir, there is no excuse, sir.
The major and the colonel nod approvingly at each other. This sir-yes-sir business, which would probably sound like horseshit to any civilian in his right mind, makes sense to Shafto and to the officers in a deep and important way. Like a lot of others, Shafto had trouble with military etiquette at first. He soaked up quite a bit of it growing up in a military family, but living the life was a different matter. Having now experienced all the phases of military existence except for the terminal ones, violent death, court-martial, retirement, he has come to understand the culture for what it is, a system of etiquette within which it becomes possible for groups of men to live together for years, travel to the ends of the earth, and do all kinds of incredibly weird shit without killing each other or completely losing their minds in the process. The extreme formality with which he addresses these officers carries an important subtext. Your problem, sir, is deciding what you want me to do, and my problem, sir, is doing it. My gung-ho posture says that once you give the order, I'm not going to bother you with any of the details. And your half of the bargain is you had better stay on your side of the line, sir, and not bother me with any of the chicken shit politics that you have to deal with for a living. The implied responsibility placed upon the officer's shoulders by the subordinate's unhesitating willingness to follow orders is a withering burden to any officer with half a brain, and Shafto has more than once seen seasoned non-coms reduce green lieutenants to quivering blobs simply by standing before them and agreeing cheerfully to carry out their orders.
This Lieutenant Reagan complained that you kept trying to tell him a story about a lizard, the major says.
Sir, yes, sir, a giant lizard, sir. An interesting story, sir,
Shafto says.
I don't care, the major says. The question is, was it an appropriate story to tell in that circumstance?
Sir, we were making our way around the coast of the island, trying to get between these nips and a Tokyo Express landing site, sir.
Shafto begins.
Shut up.
Sir, yes, sir.
There's a sweaty silence that is finally broken by the colonel.
We had the shrinks go over your statement, Sergeant Shafto.
Sir, yes, sir.
They're of the opinion that the whole giant lizard thing is a classic case of projection.
Sir, could you please tell me what the hell that is, sir?
The colonel flushes, turns his back, peers through blinds at sparse traffic out on I Street.
Well, what they are saying is that there really was no giant lizard, that you killed that Jap in hand-to-hand combat.
Men with experience in Asia use the word nip. The colonel's use of Jap suggests that his career has been spent in the Atlantic and or Caribbean.
And that your memory of the giant lizard is basically your id coming out.
Id, sir.
But there is this id thing inside your brain, and that it took over and got you fired up to kill that Jap barehanded. Then your imagination dreamed up all this crap about the giant lizard afterwards as a way of explaining it.
Sir, so you were saying that the lizard was just a metaphor, sir?
Yes.
Sir, then I would respectfully like to know how that nip got chewed in half, sir.
The colonel screws up his face dismissively.
Well, by the time you were rescued by that Coast Watcher sergeant, you had been in that cove for 3 days along with all of those dead bodies. And in that tropical heat with all those bugs and scavengers, there was no way to tell from looking at that Jap whether he had been chewed up by a giant lizard or run through a bush chipper, if you know what I mean.
Sir, yes I do, sir!
The major goes back to the report.
This Reagan fellow says that you also repeatedly made disparaging comments about General MacArthur.
Sir, yes, sir! He is a son of a bitch who hates the Corps, sir! He is trying to get us all killed, sir!
The major and the colonel look at each other. It is clear that they have, wordlessly, just arrived at some decision.
Since you insist on re-enlisting, the typical thing would be to have you go around the country showing off your medals and recruiting young men into the Corps. But this lizard story kind of rules that out.
Sir, I do not understand, sir.
The recruitment office has reviewed your file. They've seen Reagan's report. They are nervous that you're going to be in West Bumfuck, Arkansas, riding in the Memorial Day parade in your shiny dress uniform, and suddenly you're going to start spouting all kinds of nonsense about lizards and scare everyone shitless and put a kink in the war effort.
Sir, I respectfully...
Permission to speak denied, the major says. I won't even get into your obsession with General MacArthur.
Sir, the general is a murdering...
Shut up.
Sir, yes, sir.
We have another job for you, Marine.
Sir, yes, sir.
You're going to be part of something very special.
Sir, the Marine Raiders are already a very special part of a very special corps, sir.
That's not what I mean. I mean that this assignment is unusual.
The major looks over at the colonel. He is not sure how to proceed. The colonel puts his hand in his pocket, jingles coins, then reaches up and checks his shave.
It is not exactly a Marine Corps assignment, he finally says. You will be part of a special international detachment. An American Marine Raider platoon and a British Special Air Services squadron operating together under one command. A bunch of tough hombres who've shown they can handle any assignments under any conditions. Is that a fair description of you, Marine?
Sir, yes, sir!
It is a very unusual setup, the colonel muses. Not the kind of thing that military men would ever dream up. Do you know what I'm saying, Shafto?
Sir, no, sir, but I do detect a strong odor of politics in the room now, sir.
The colonel gets a little twinkle in his eye and glances out the window towards the Capitol dome.
These politicians can be real picky about how they get things done. Everything has to be just so. They don't like excuses. You follow me, Shafto?
Sir, yes, sir.
The Corps had to fight to get this. They were going to make it an army thing. We pulled a few strings with some formal naval persons in high places. Now the assignment is ours. Some would say it is ours to screw up.
Sir, the assignment will not be screwed up, sir!
The reason that son of a bitch MacArthur is killing Marines like flies down in the South Pacific is because sometimes we don't play the political game that well. If you and your new unit do not perform brilliantly, that situation will only worsen.
Sir, you can rely on this Marine, sir!
Your commanding officer will be Lieutenant Etheridge, an Annapolis man. Not much combat experience, but knows how to move in the right circles. He can run interference for you at the political level. The responsibility for getting things done on the ground will be entirely yours, Sergeant Shafto.
Sir, yes, sir!
You'll be working closely with British Special Air Service. Very good men. But I want you and your men to outshine them.
Sir, you can count on it, sir!
Well, get ready to ship out, then,
the major says.
You're on your way to North Africa, Sergeant Shafto.
Londinium. The massive British coinage clanks in his pocket like pewter dinner plates. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse walks down a street wearing the uniform of a commander in the United States Navy. This must not be taken to imply that he is actually a commander, or indeed that he is even in the Navy, though he is. The United States part is, however, a safe bet, because every time he arrives at a curb, he either comes close to being run over by a shooting brake, or he falters in his stride, diverts his train of thought onto a siding, much to the disturbance of its passengers and crew, and throws some large part of his mental calculation circuitry into the job of trying to reflect his surroundings through a large mirror. They drive on the left side of the street here. He knew about that before he came. He had seen pictures, and Alan had complained of it in Princeton, always nearly being run over as, lost in thought, he stepped off curbs, looking the wrong way. The curbs are sharp and perpendicular, not like the American smoothly molded sigmoid cross-section curves. The transition between the sidewalk and the street is a crisp vertical. If you put a green light bulb on Waterhouse's head and watched him from the side during the blackout, his trajectory would look just like a square wave traced out on the face of a single-beam oscilloscope. Up, down, up, down. If he were doing this at home, the curbs would be evenly spaced, about 12 to the mile, because his hometown is neatly laid out on a grid. Here in London, the street pattern is irregular, and so the transitions in the square wave come at random-seeming times, sometimes very close together, sometimes very far apart. A scientist watching the wave would probably despair of finding any pattern. It would look like a random circuit, driven by noise, triggered perhaps by the arrival of cosmic rays from deep space, or the decay of radioactive isotopes. But if he had depth and ingenuity, it would be a different matter. Depth could be obtained by putting a green light bulb on the head of every person in London, and then recording their tracings for a few nights. The result would be a thick pile of graph paper tracings, each one as seemingly random as the others. The thicker the pile, the greater the depth. Ingenuity is a completely different matter. There is no systematic way to get it. One person could look at the pile of square wave tracings and see nothing but noise. Another might find a source of fascination there, an irrational feeling impossible to explain to anyone who did not share it. Some deep part of the mind, adept at noticing patterns or the existence of a pattern, would stir awake and frantically signal the dull quotidian parts of the brain to keep looking at the pile of graph paper. The signal is dim and not always heeded, but it would instruct the recipient to stand there for days if necessary, shuffling through the pile of graphs like an autist, spreading them out over a large floor, stacking them in piles according to some inscrutable system, penciling numbers and letters from dead alphabets into the corners, cross-referencing them, finding patterns, cross-checking them against others. One day this person would walk out of that room carrying a highly accurate street map of London, reconstructed from the information in all of those square-wave plots. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is one of those people. As a result, the authorities of his country, the United States of America, have made him swear a mickle oath of secrecy and keep supplying him with new uniforms of various services and ranks, and now have sent him to London. He steps off a curb, glancing reflexively to the left. A jingling sounds in his right ear, bicycle brakes trumpet. It is merely a Royal Marine. Waterhouse is beginning to recognize the uniforms. Off on some errand. But he has reinforcements behind him in the form of a bus coach painted all of drab and stenciled all over with inscrutable code numbers.
Pardon me, sir,
the Royal Marine says brightly and swerves around him, apparently reckoning that the coach can handle any mopping up work. Waterhouse leaps forward, directly into the path of a black taxi coming the other way. After making it across that particular street, though, he arrives at his Westminster destination without further life-threatening incidents, unless you count being a few minutes' airplane ride from a tightly organized horde of murderous Germans with the best weapons in the world. He has found himself in a part of town that seems almost like certain lightless, hemmed-in parts of Manhattan. Narrow streets lined with buildings on the order of 10 stories high. Occasional glimpses of ancient and mighty Gothic piles at street ends clue him into the fact that he is nigh unto greatness. As in Manhattan, the people walk fast, each with some clear purpose in mind. The amended heels of the pedestrian's wartime shoes pop metallically. Each pedestrian has a fairly consistent stride length and clicks with nearly metronomic precision. A microphone in the sidewalk would provide an eavesdropper with a cacophony of clicks, seemingly random, like the noise from a Geiger counter. but the right kind of person could abstract signal from noise and count the pedestrians, provide a male-female breakdown, and a leg-length histogram. He has to stop this. He would like to concentrate on the matter at hand, but that is still a mystery. A massive, blocky modern sculpture sits over the door of the St. James's Park tube station, doing 24-hour surveillance on the Broadway buildings, which is actually just a single building. Like every other intelligence headquarters Waterhouse has seen, it is a great disappointment. It is, after all, just a building. Orange stone, 10 or so stories, an unreasonably high mansard roof, accounting for the top three, some smidgens of classical ornament above the windows, which, like all windows in London, are divided into 8 right triangles by strips of masking tape. Waterhouse finds that this look blends better with classical architecture than, say, Gothic. He has some grounding in physics and finds it implausible that when a few hundred pounds of trinitrotoluene are set off in the neighborhood and the resulting shockwave propagates through a large pane of glass, the people on the other side of it will derive any benefit from an asterisk of paper tape. It is a superstitious gesture, like hexes on Pennsylvania Dutch farmhouses. The sight of it probably helps keep people's minds focused on the war. Which doesn't seem to be working for Waterhouse. He makes his way carefully across the street, thinking very hard about the direction of the traffic, on the assumption that someone inside will be watching him. He goes inside, holding the door for a fearsomely brisk young woman in a quasi-military outfit, who makes it clear that Waterhouse had better not expect to get anywhere just because he's holding the door for her. And then for a tired-looking septuagenarian gent with a white mustache. The lobby is well guarded, and there is some business with Waterhouse's credentials and his orders. Then he makes the obligatory mistake of going to the wrong floor because they are numbered differently here. This would be a lot funnier if this were not a military intelligence headquarters in the thick of the greatest war in the history of the world. When he does get to the right floor, though, it is a bit posher than the wrong one was. Of course, the underlying structure of everything in England is posh. There is no in-between with these people. You have to walk a mile to find a telephone booth, but when you find it, it is built as if the senseless dynamiting of payphones had been a serious problem at some time in the past. And a British mailbox can presumably stop a German tank. None of them have cars, but when they do, they are 3-ton hand-built beasts. The concept of stamping out a whole lot of cars is unthinkable. There are certain procedures that have to be followed, Mr. Ford, such as the hand-brazing of radiators, the traditional whittling of the tires from solid blocks of caoutchouc. Meetings are all the same. Waterhouse is always the guest. He has never actually hosted a meeting. The guest arrives at an unfamiliar building, sits in a waiting area, declining offers of caffeinated beverages from a personable but chaste female, and is in time ushered to the room where the main guy and the other guys are awaiting him. There is a system of introductions, which the guest need not concern himself with because he is operating in a passive mode and need only respond to stimuli, shaking all hands that are offered, declining all further offers of caffeinated and, now, alcoholic beverages, sitting down when and where invited. In this case, the main guy and all but one of the other guys happen to be British. The selection of beverages is slightly different. The room, being British, is thrown together from blocks of stone like a pharaoh's inner tomb, and the windows have the usual unconvincing strips of tape on them. The predictable humor phase is much shorter than in America, the chit-chat phase longer. Waterhouse has forgotten all of their names. He always immediately forgets the names. Even if he remembered them, he would not know their significance, as he does not actually have the organization chart of the Foreign Ministry, which runs intelligence, and the military laid out in front of him. They keep saying, "Wota Heiss." But just as he actually begins to feel sorry for this Heiss fellow, whoever he is, he figures out that this is how they pronounce Waterhouse. Other than that, the one remark that actually penetrates his brain is when one of the other guys says something about the Prime Minister that implies considerable familiarity. And he's not even the main guy. The main guy is much older and more distinguished. So it seems to Waterhouse, though he has completely stopped listening to what all these people are saying to him, that a good half of the people in the room have recently had conversations with Winston Churchill. Then, suddenly, certain words come into the conversation. Waterhouse was not paying attention, but he is pretty sure that within the last 10 seconds, the word ultra was uttered. He blinks and sits up straighter. The main guy looks bemused. The other guys look startled. Was something said a few minutes ago about the availability of coffee? Waterhouse says.
Miss Stanhope, coffee for Captain Waterhouse,
says the main guy into an electrical intercom. It is one of only half a dozen office intercoms in the British Empire. However, it is cast in a solid ingot from 100 pounds of iron and fed by 420-volt cables as thick as Waterhouse's index finger.
And if you would be so good as to bring tea?
So now Waterhouse knows the name of the main guy's secretary. That's a start. From that, with a bit of research, he might be able to recover the memory of the main guy's name. This seems to have thrown them back into the chit-chat phase. And though American important guys would be fuming and frustrated, the Brits seem enormously relieved. Even more beverages are ordered from Miss Stanhope.
Have you seen Dr. Schoen recently?
The main guy inquires of Waterhouse. He has a touch of concern in his voice.
Who?
Then Waterhouse realizes that the person in question is Commander Schoen, and that here in London, the name is apt to be pronounced correctly. Schoen instead of Shane.
Commander Waterhouse,
the main guy says, several minutes later. On the fly, Waterhouse has been trying to invent a new cryptosystem based upon alternative systems of pronouncing words, and hasn't said anything in quite a while. Oh, yeah, well, I stopped in briefly and paid my respects to Schoen before getting on the ship. Of course, when he's, feeling under the weather, everyone's under strict orders not to talk cryptology with him.
Of course.
The problem is that when your whole relationship with the fellow is built around cryptology, you can't even really poke your head in the door without violating that order.
Yes, it is most awkward.
I guess he's doing okay. Waterhouse does not say this very convincingly, and there is an appropriate silence around the table.
When he was in better spirits, he wrote glowingly of your work on the Cryptonomicon,
says one of the other guys, who has not spoken very much until now. Waterhouse pegs him as some kind of unspecified mover and shaker in the world of machine cryptology.
Yeah, he's a heck of a fella, Waterhouse says.
The main guy uses this as an opening.
Because of your work with Dr. Schoen's indigo machine, you are by definition on the magic list. Now that this country and yours have agreed, at least in principle, to cooperate in the field of cryptanalysis, this automatically puts you on the ultra list.
I understand, sir, Waterhouse says.
Ultra and magic are more symmetrical than not. In each case, a belligerent power has developed a machine cipher which it considers to be perfectly unbreakable. In each case, an allied power has in fact broken that cipher. In America, Dr. Schoen and his team broke Indigo and devised the magic machine. Here, it was Dr. Knox's team that broke Enigma and devised the bomb. The leading light here seems to have been Dr. Turing. The leading light with you chaps was Dr. Schoen, who is, as you said, under the weather. But he holds you up as comparable to Turing, Commander Waterhouse.
That's pretty darn generous, Waterhouse says.
But you studied with Turing at Princeton, did you not?
We were there at the same time, if that's what you mean. We rode bikes. His work was a lot more advanced.
But Turing was pursuing graduate studies. You were merely an undergraduate,
Well, sure, but even allowing for that, he's way smarter than me.
You are too modest, Captain Waterhouse. How many undergraduates have published papers in international journals,
We just rode bikes, Waterhouse insists. Einstein wouldn't give me the time of day.
Dr. Turing has shown himself to be rather handy with information theory,
says a prematurely haggard guy with long, limp gray hair, whom Waterhouse now pegs as some sort of Oxbridge Don.
You must have discussed this with him.
The Don turns to the others and says, donishly,
information theory would inform a mechanical calculator in much the same way as, say, fluid dynamics would inform the hull of a ship.
Then he turns back to Waterhouse and says,
somewhat less formally. Dr. Turing has continued to develop his work on the subject since he vanished, from your point of view, into the realm of the classified. Of particular interest has been the subject of just how much information can be extracted from seemingly random data.
Suddenly all of the other people in the room are exchanging those amused looks again.
I gather from your reaction, says the main guy, that this has been of continuing interest to you as well,
Waterhouse wonders what his reaction was. Did he grow fangs? Drool into his coffee?
That's good, says the main guy, before Waterhouse can answer. Because it is of the highest interest to us as well. You see, now that we are making efforts, and I must emphasize the preliminary and unsatisfactory level of these efforts to this point, to coordinate intelligence between America and Britain, we find ourselves in the oddest situation that has ever faced a pair of allies in a war. We know everything, Commander Wotice. We receive Hitler's personal communications to his theater commanders, frequently before the commanders do. This knowledge is obviously a powerful tool, but just as obviously it cannot help us win the war unless we allow it to change our actions. That is, if, through Ultra, we become aware of a convoy sailing from Taranto to supply Rommel in North Africa, the knowledge does us no good unless we go out and sink that convoy.
Clearly, Waterhouse says.
Now, if 10 convoys are sent out and all of them are sunk, even those under cover of clouds and darkness, the Germans will ask themselves how we knew where those convoys could be found. They will realize that we have penetrated the Enigma cipher and change it, and this tool will be lost to us. It is safe to say that Mr. Churchill will be displeased by such an outcome.
The main guy looks at all of the others, who nod knowingly. Waterhouse gets the feeling that Mr. Churchill has been bearing down rather hard on this particular point.
Let us recast this in information theory terms, says the Don. Information flows from Germany to us through the Ultra system at Bletchley Park. That information comes to us as seemingly random Morse code transmissions on a wireless. But because we have very bright people who can discover order in what is seemingly random, we can extract information that is crucial to our endeavors. Now, the Germans have not broken our important ciphers, but they can observe our actions, the routing of our convoys in the North Atlantic, the deployment of our air forces. If the convoys always avoid the U-boats, if the air forces always go straight to the German convoys, then it is clear to the Germans, I'm speaking of a very bright sort of German here, a German of the professor type, that there is not randomness here. This German can find correlations. He can see that we know more than we should. In other words, there is a certain point at which information begins to flow from us back to the Germans.
We need to know where that point is,
says the main guy.
Exactly where it is. We need then to stay on the right side of it, to develop the appearance of randomness.
Yes, Waterhouse says, and it has to be a kind of randomness that would convince someone like Rudolf von Hackelhaber.
Exactly the fellow we had in mind, the Don says. Dr. von Hackelhaber, as of last year.
Oh, Waterhouse says. Rudy got his Ph.D.? Since Rudy got called back into the embrace of the Thousand-Year Reich, Waterhouse has assumed the worst, imagining him out there in a greatcoat, sleeping in drifts and besieging Leningrad or something. But apparently the Nazis, with their sharp eye for talent, as long as it isn't Jewish talent, have given him a desk job. Still, it's touch and go for a while after Waterhouse shows pleasure that Rudy's okay. One of the other guys, trying to break the ice, jokes that if someone had had the foresight to lock Rudy up in New Jersey for the duration, there would be no need for the new category of secret known as Ultra Mega. No one seems to think it's funny, so Waterhouse assumes it's true. They show him the organizational chart for RAF Special Detachment Number 2701, which contains the names of all of the 24 people in the world who are on to Ultra Mega. The top is cluttered with names such as Winston Churchill and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Then come some other names that seem oddly familiar to Waterhouse. Perhaps the names of these very gents here in this room. Below them, one Chatton, a youngish RAF colonel who, Waterhouse is assured, accomplished some very fine things during the Battle of Britain. In the next rank of the chart is the name Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse. There are two other names. One is an RAF captain, and the other is a captain in the United States Marine Corps. There is also a dotted line veering off to one side, leading to the name Dr. Alan Matheson Turing. Taken as a whole, this chart may be the most irregular and bizarre adhocracy ever grafted onto a military organization. In the bottom row of the chart are two groups of half a dozen names, clustered beneath the names of the RAF captain and the Marine captain, respectively. These are the squads that represent the executive wing of the organization. As one of the guys at the Broadway building puts it,
"The men at the coalface."
And as the one American guy translates it for him,
"This is where the rubber meets the road."
"Do you have any questions?"
the main guy asks. Did Alan choose the number?"
"You mean Dr. Turing?"
"Yes. Did he choose the number 2701? This level of detail is clearly several ranks beneath the station of the men in the Broadway buildings. They look startled and almost offended, as if Waterhouse has suddenly asked them to take dictation.
Possibly,
says the main guy.
Why do you ask?
Because, Waterhouse says, the number 2701 is the product of two primes, and those numbers, 37 and 73, when expressed in decimal notation, are, as you can plainly see, the reverse of each other. All heads swivel toward the Don, who looks put out.
We had best change that, he says. It is the sort of thing that Dr. von Hackelhaber would notice.
He stands up, withdraws a Mont Blanc fountain pen from his pocket, and amends the organizational chart so that it reads 2702 instead of 2701. As he is doing this, Waterhouse looks at the other men in the room and thinks that they look satisfied. Clearly, this is just the sort of parlor trick they have hired Waterhouse to perform.
Corregidor. There is no fixed boundary between the water of Manila Bay and the humid air above it, only a featureless blue-gray shroud hanging a couple of miles away. Glory 4 maneuvers cautiously through an immense strewing of anchored cargo ships for about half an hour, then picks up speed and heads out into the center of the bay. The air thins a bit, allowing Randy a good view of Bataan off to starboard, black mountains mostly veiled in haze and speckled by the mushroom-capped shaped clouds of ascending thermals. For the most part, it has no beaches, just red cliffs plummeting the last few yards into the sea. But as they work their way out to the end of the peninsula, the land tails off more gently and supports a few pale green fields. At the very tip of Bataan are a couple of stabbing limestone crags that Randy recognizes from Avi's video, but by this point he has eyes mostly for Corregidor itself, which lies a few miles off the end of the peninsula. America Shafto, or Amy as she likes to be called, spends most of the voyage bustling around on the deck, engaging the Filipino and American divers in bursts of serious conversation, sometimes sitting cross-legged on the deck plates to go over papers or charts. She has donned a frayed straw cowboy hat to protect her head from solar radiation. Randy's in no hurry to expose himself. He ambles around the air-conditioned cabin, sipping his coffee and looking at the photographs on the walls. He is naively expecting to see pictures of divers landing submarine cables on beaches. Semper Marine Services does a fair amount of cable work and does it well. He checked their references before hiring them, but they apparently do not consider that kind of work interesting enough to photograph. Most of these pictures are of undersea salvage operations. Divers with enormous grins on their leathery faces, triumphantly holding up barnacle-encrusted vases, like hockey players brandishing the Stanley Cup. From a distance, Corregidor is a lens of jungle bulging out of the water with a flat shelf extending off to one side. From the maps, he knows that it is really a sperm-shaped affair. What looks like a shell from this angle is its tail, which snakes off to the east as if the sperm were trying to swim out of Manila Bay to impregnate Asia. Amy storms past and throws the cabin door open. "Come to the bridge," she says. "You should see this."
Randy follows her.
Who's the guy in most of those pictures? He asks.
Scary? Crew cut?
Yeah.
That's my father, she says. Doug.
Would that be Douglas MacArthur, Shafto?
Randy asks.
He's seen the name on some of the documents that he's exchanged with Semper Marine.
The same.
The ex-SEAL?
Yeah, but he doesn't like to be referred to that way. It is such a cliche.
Why does he seem familiar to me?
Amy sighs.
He had his 15 minutes of fame back in 1975.
I'm having trouble remembering.
You know Comstock?
Attorney General Paul Comstock? Hates crypto?
I'm talking about his father, Earl Comstock.
Cold War policy guy, the brains behind the Vietnam War, right?
I've never heard him described that way, but yeah, we're talking about the same guy.
You might remember that back in 1975, Earl Comstock fell or was pushed off a ski lift in Colorado and broke his arms?
Oh, yeah, it's sort of coming back to me.
My pop, Amy does a little head fake towards one of the photographs, happened to be seated right next to him at the time.
By accident or total chance, not planned?
Well, that's one way to look at it, Randy says.
But on the other hand, if Earl Comstock went skiing frequently, the probability was actually rather high that sooner or later he'd find himself sitting 50 feet off the ground next to a Vietnam combat veteran.
Whatever. All I'm saying is, I don't want to talk about it, actually.
Am I going to get to meet this character?
Randy asks, looking at the photograph. Amy bites her lip and squints at the horizon.
90% of the time his presence is a sign that something really weird is going on.
She opens the hatch to the bridge and holds it for him, pointing out the high step.
The other 10%?
He's bored, or on the outs with his girlfriend.
Glory's pilot is concentrating intensely and ignores them, which Randy takes to be a sign of professionalism. The bridge has many counters fashioned from doors or thick plywood, and all of the available space is covered with electronic gear. A fax, a smaller machine that spews out weather bulletins, 3 computers, a satellite phone, a few GSM phones socketed into their chargers, depth-sounding gear.
Amy leads him over to a machine with a big screen that is showing what looks like a black-and-white photo of rugged terrain.
Side-scan sonar, she explains. One of our best tools for this kind of work. Shows us what's on the bottom.
She checks one of the computer screens for their current coordinates and then runs a quick calculation in her head.
Ernesto, change course 5 degrees to starboard, please.
Yes, ma'am,
Ernesto says, and makes it happen.
What are you looking for?
This is a freebie, like the cigarettes at the hotel,
Amy explains.
Just an extra added bonus for doing business with us. Sometimes we like to play tour guide. See? Check that out.
She uses her pinky to point out something that is just becoming visible on the screen. Randy hunches over and peers at it. It is clearly a man-made shape, a jumble of straight lines and right angles.
Looks like a heap of debris, he says.
It is now, Amy says, but it used to be a good chunk of the Filipino treasury.
What?
During the war, Amy says, after Pearl Harbor, but before the Japanese took Manila, the government emptied out the treasury. They put all the gold and silver into crates and shipped it to Corregidor for safekeeping, supposedly.
What do you mean, supposedly?
She shrugs.
This is the Philippines, she says. I have the feeling a lot of it ended up elsewhere, but a lot of the silver ended up there.
She straightens up and nods out the window at Corregidor.
At the time, they thought Corregidor was impregnable.
When was this, roughly?
December 41 or January 42? Anyway, it became obvious that Corregidor was going to fall. A submarine came and took away the gold at the beginning of February. Then another sub came and took off guys they couldn't allow to be captured, like codebreakers. But they didn't have enough subs to carry away all the silver. MacArthur left in March. They started taking the silver out in crates in the middle of the night and dropping it into the water.
You're shitting me.
They could always come back later and try to recover it, Amy says.
Better to lose it all than let the Japanese take it, right?
I guess so.
The Japanese recovered a lot of that silver. They captured a bunch of American divers on Bataan and Corregidor and made them go down, right down below where we are at this moment, and recover it. But those same divers managed to hide a lot of silver from their guards and get it to Filipinos who smuggled it into Manila, where it became so common that it totally debased the Japanese occupation currency.
So what are we seeing right now?
The remains of old crates that burst open when they hit the seafloor, Amy says.
Was there any of that silver left when the war ended?
Oh, sure, Amy says breezily. Most of it was dumped here, and those divers got it, but some was dumped in other areas. My dad recovered some of it as late as the 1970s.
Wow. That doesn't make any sense.
Why not?
I can't believe that piles of silver just sat on the bottom of the ocean for 30 years, free for the taking.
You don't know the Philippines very well, Amy says.
I know that it's a poor country.
Why didn't someone come out and get that silver? Most of the treasure hunters in this part of the world are looking for much bigger game, Amy says. Or easier.
Randy's nonplussed. A pile of silver on the bottom of the bay seems big and easy to me.
It's not. Silver's not worth that much. A Sung Dynasty vase, cleaned up, can go for more than its weight in gold.
Gold.
And it's easier to find the vase. You just scan the seafloor looking for something shaped like a junk. A sunken junk makes a distinctive image on sonar, whereas an old crate, all busted up and covered with coral and barnacles, tends to look like a rock.
As they draw closer to Corregidor, Randy can see that the tail of the island is lumpy, with big stacks of rock protruding from it here and there. The color of the land fades gradually from dark jungle green to pale green, and then a sear reddish brown as the tail extends from the fat center of the island out to the end, and the soil becomes drier. Randy's gaze is fixed on one of those rocky crags, which is surmounted by a new steel tower. Atop the tower is a microwave horn aimed east, toward Epiphyte's building in Intramuros.
See those caves along the waterline? Amy says.
She seems to regret having mentioned sunken treasure in the first place, and now wants to get off the subject.
Randy tears himself away from admiring the microwave antenna, of which he is part owner, and looks in the direction Amy's pointing. The limestone flank of the island, which drops vertically the last few meters into the water, is riddled with holes.
Yeah.
Built by Americans to house beach defense guns. Enlarged by the Japanese as launch sites for suicide boats.
Wow.
Randy notices a deep gargling noise and looks over to see that a boat has fallen in alongside them. It is a canoe-shaped affair, maybe 40 feet long, with long outriggers on either side. A couple of ragged flags fly from a short mast, and bright laundry flaps gaily from various lines strung here and there. A big, naked diesel engine sits in the middle of the hull, flailing the atmosphere with black smoke. Forward of that, several Filipinos, including women and children, are gathered in the shade of a bright blue tarpaulin, eating. Aft, a couple of men are fiddling with diving equipment. One of them is holding something up to his mouth, a microphone. A voice blares from Glory's radio, speaking Tagalog. Ernesto stifles a laugh, picks up the mic, and answers briefly. Randy doesn't know what they are saying, but he suspects it is something like, "Let's horse around later. Our client is on the bridge right now."
"Business associates," Amy explains dryly.
Her body language says that she wants to get away from Randy and back to work.
"Well, thanks for the tour," Randy says.
One question. Amy raises her eyebrows, trying to look patient. "How much of Semper Marine's revenue derives from treasure hunting?
This month, this year, the last 10 years, over the lifetime of the company?" Amy asks.
"Whatever."
"That kind of income is sporadic," Amy says. "Glory was paid for, and then some by pottery that we recovered from a junk. But some years we get all of our revenue from jobs like this one."
"In other words, boring jobs that suck," Randy says.
He just blurts it out. Normally he controls his tongue a little better, but shaving off his beard has blurred his ego boundaries, or something.
He's expecting her to laugh, or at least wink at him, but she takes it very seriously. She has a pretty good poker face.
Think of it as making license plates, she says.
So you guys are basically a bunch of treasure hunters, Randy says. You just make license plates to stabilize your cash flow.
Call us treasure hunters if you like, Amy says. Why are you in business, Randy?
She turns around and stalks out of the place. Randy's still watching her go when he hears Ernesto cursing under his breath, not so much angry as astonished. Glory is swinging around the tip of Corregidor's tail now, and the entire southern side of the island is becoming visible for the first time. The last mile or so of the tail curves around to form a semicircular bay. Anchored in the center of this bay is a white ship that Randy identifies, at first, as a small ocean liner with rakish and wicked lines. Then he sees the name painted on its stern, Rui Falero, Santa Monica, California. Randy goes and stands next to Ernesto, and they stare at the white ship for a while. Randy has heard about it, and Ernesto, like everyone else in the Philippines, knows about it. But seeing it is another thing entirely. A helicopter sits on its afterdeck like a toy. A dagger-shaped muscle boat hangs from a davit, ready for use as a dinghy. A brown-skinned man in a gleaming white uniform can be seen polishing a brass rail. Rui Falero was Magellan's cosmographer, Randy says.
Cosmographer?
The brains of the operation, Randy says, tapping his head.
He came here with Magellan? Ernesto asks.
In most of the world, Magellan is thought of as the first guy who went around the world. Here, everyone knows he only made it as far as Mactan Island, where he was killed by Filipinos. When Magellan set out on his ship, Falero stayed behind in Seville, Randy says. He went crazy.
You know a lot about Magallanes, eh? Ernesto says.
No, Randy says.
I know a lot about the dentist.
Don't talk to the dentist, ever. Not about anything, not even tech stuff. Any technical questions he asks you is just a stalking horse for some business tactic that is as far beyond your comprehension as Girdle's proof would be to Daffy Duck.
Avi told Randy this spontaneously one evening as they were tucking into dinner at a restaurant in downtown Makati. Avi refuses to discuss anything important within a mile of the Manila Hotel because he thinks every room and every table is under surveillance.
Well, thanks for the vote of confidence, Randy said.
Hey, Avi said, I'm just trying to stake out my turf here, justify my existence in this project. I'll handle the business stuff.
You're not being a little paranoid?
Listen, the dentist has at least $1 billion of his own and another $10 billion under management. Half the fucking orthodontists in Southern California retired at age 40 because he decupled their IRAs in the space of 2 or 3 years. You don't achieve those kinds of results by being a nice guy. Maybe he just got lucky. He did get lucky. But that doesn't mean he's a nice guy. My point is that he put that money into investments that were extremely risky. He played Russian roulette with his investors' life savings, keeping them in the dark. I mean, this guy would invest in a Mindanao kidnapping ring if it gave a good rate of return.
Does he understand that he was lucky, I wonder?
That's my question. I'm guessing no. I think he considers himself to be an instrument of divine providence like Douglas MacArthur.
Rui Falero is the pride of Seattle's superyacht industry, which has been burgeoning ever so discreetly of late. Randy gleaned a few facts about it from a marketing brochure that was published before the dentist actually bought the ship, so he knows that the helicopter and the speedboat came included in the purchase price, which has never been divulged. The vessel contains, among other things, 10 tons of marble. The master bedroom suite contains full his and hers bathrooms, lined with black marble and pink marble, respectively, so that the dentist and the diva don't have to fight over sink space when they are primping for a big event in the grand ballroom.
The dentist? Ernesto says.
Kepler. Dr. Kepler, Randy says. In the States, some people call him the dentist. People in the high-tech industry.
Ernesto nods knowingly.
A man like that could have had any woman in the world, he says. But he picked a Filipina.
Yes, says Randy cautiously.
In the States, do people know the story of Victoria Vigo?
I must tell you that she is not as famous in the States as she is here.
Of course.
But some of her songs were very popular. Many people know that she came from great poverty.
Do people in the States know about Smoky Mountain, the garbage dump in Tondo, where children hunt for food?
Some of them do. It will be very famous when the movie about Victoria Vigo's life shows on television.
Ernesto nods, seemingly satisfied.
Everyone here knows that a movie about the diva's life is being made, starring herself. They generally don't know that it's a vanity project, financed by the dentist, and that it will be aired only on cable television in the middle of the night. But they probably know that it will leave out all the good parts.
As far as the dentist is concerned, Avi said, our advantage is that when it comes to the Philippines, he will be predictable. Tame, even docile. He smiles cryptically.
How so?
Victoria Vigo whored her way up out of Smoky Mountain, right?
Well, there seems to be a lot of nudging and winking to that effect, but I've never heard anyone come out and say it before,
Randy said, glancing around nervously.
Believe me, it's the only way she could have gotten out of there. Pimping arrangements were handled by the Bolobolos. This is a group from northern Luzon that was brought into power along with Marcos. They run that part of town. Police, organized crime, local politics, you name it. Consequently, they own her. They have photographs, videos from the days when she was an underage prostitute and porn film starlet.
Randy shook his head in disgust and amazement.
How the hell do you get this information? Never mind. Believe me, in some circles, it's as well known as the value of pi. Not my circles. Anyway, the point is that her interests are aligned with the Bolobolos and always will be. And the dentist is always going to obediently do whatever his wife tells him to.
Can you really assume that?
Randy said.
He's a tough guy. He probably has a lot more money and power than the Bolobolos. He can do whatever he wants.
But he won't, Avi says, smiling that little smile again. He'll do what his wife tells him to.
How do you know that?
Look, Avi said. Kepler is a major control freak, just like most powerful rich men, right?
Right.
If you are that much of a control freak, what sexual preferences does that translate into?
I hope I'll never know. I suppose you would want to dominate a woman.
Wrong, Avi said. Sex is more complicated than that, Randy. Sex is a place where people's repressed desires come out. People get most turned on when their innermost secrets are revealed. Shit. Kepler's a masochist? He is such a fucking masochist that he was famous for it. At least in the Southeast Asian sex industry. Pimps and madams in Hong Kong, Bangkok, Shenzhen, Manila, they all had files on him. They knew exactly what he wanted. And that's how he met Victoria Vigo. He was in Manila, see, working on the Philatel deal. Spent a lot of time here, staying in a hotel that's owned and bugged by the Bolobolos. They studied his mating habits like entomologists watching the reproductive habits of ants. They groomed Victoria Vigo, their ace, their bombshell, their sexual terminator, to give Kepler exactly what Kepler wanted. Then they sent her into his life like a guided fucking missile and pow, true love.
You think he would have been suspicious or something? I'm surprised he'd get that involved with a whore.
He didn't know she was a whore. That's the beauty of the plan. The Bolobolos set her up with a fake identity as a concierge at Kepler's hotel, a demure Catholic schoolgirl. It starts with her getting him tickets to a play. And inside of a year, he's chained to his bed on that fucking mega yacht of his with strap marks on his ass, and she's standing over him with a wedding ring on her finger the size of a headlamp. The 138th richest woman in the world.
125th, Randy corrected him. Philatel stock has been on a bull run lately.
Randy spends the next days trying not to run into the dentist. He stays at a small private inn up on the top of the island, eating continental breakfast every morning with an assortment of American and Nipponese war veterans who have come here with their wives to, Randy supposes, deal with emotional issues a million times more profound than anything Randy's ever had to contend with. The Ruy Falero is nothing if not conspicuous, and Randy can get a pretty good idea of whether the dentist is aboard it by watching the movements of the helicopter and the speedboat. When he thinks it's safe, he goes down to the beach below the microwave antenna and watches Amy's divers work on the cable installation. Some of them are working out in the surf zone, bolting sections of cast iron pipe around the cable. Some are working a couple of miles offshore, coordinating with a barge that is injecting the cable directly into the muddy seafloor with a giant cleaver-like appendage.